They tied wires to my hands and put metal clippers on my ears to electrocute me. They wanted to get names of my gay friends.
If you don't have proof, then I'm not guilty.
There's quite a few gargoyles in the gang. You know, people are nuts. We celebrate that. If anything, it makes it more rounded.
And we're all fragile, genuine people underneath with emotions, and we're a hot mess of real life. We're real people. The whole point is getting on stage, performing. Your vulnerability is at home. You deal with that when you go home.
We're just showing people the London side of drag.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Refugee voices describe anti-gay terror in Chechnya, homophobic crackdowns resume in Nigeria and Iran, but London dragsters find high drama in high heels dressed as a girl. Those stories and more this week because you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Jessica Andrea.
And I'm Michael LeBeau.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBT communities around the world for the week ending April 22nd, 2017. The week has brought mostly bad news for LGBTQ people and those who support them. 53 young men were arrested in Nigeria on April 15th at a motel in the northern city of Zaria. Prosecutor Munir Nasir told a court on April 19th that the defendants were legally celebrating the marriage of a gay couple. The BBC reported that their defense lawyer says the young men, most of them students, were arrested at a birthday party, not a wedding. Each has pleaded not guilty to charges of conspiracy, unlawful assembly, and belonging to a gang of unlawful society. They were all released on bail, and their next hearing is scheduled for May 8th. Nigerian law denies civil marriage to same-gender couples, and under draconian legislation passed in 2013, couples can be jailed for up to 14 years for attempting any form of same-gender union. Anyone who witnesses, abets, and aids the solemnization of a same-sex marriage or civil union can be sentenced to up to 10 years.
Private consensual adult gay sex itself is punishable by up to 14 years in prison in secular Nigeria. Punishment can be much harsher in northern areas of the country governed by Islamic law. There was a near lynching of about a dozen men accused of sodomy in northern Bauchi State in 2014. The gay couple, supposedly being celebrated at that party this week, managed to evade police and are in hiding at a safe house, fearing mob violence if they are discovered.
A Canadian LGBTQ rights group dedicated to defending queer people in Iran reported that more than 30 men thought to be gay were beaten and arrested this week during a violent police raid of a private party in Esfahan province. According to Canada's Iranian Railroad for Queer Refugees, police fired their guns in the air while rounding up the men, some of whom managed to escape. At least a few heterosexual men were apparently netted in the raid. The human rights NGO said that all the detainees are being charged with sodomy, drinking alcohol, and using psychedelic drugs. Each of the detainees will reportedly be forced to undergo anal examinations in order to provide evidence of homosexual acts to the court. That barbaric practice has been widely discredited as medically bogus. Several human rights groups also call the horribly invasive procedure torture. The Iranian Railroad for Queer Refugees reported that this week's detainees were also forced to write down the full names of all of their LGBTQ friends and acquaintances who themselves will presumably be subject to eventual arrest, interrogation, and detention. The Islamic Republic of Iran has a well-documented history of persecuting sexual and gender-variant minorities. Its laws punish same-gender sex with lengthy prison terms, corporal punishment, or even execution.
In other news, the police officer killed in the April 20th terrorist attack on the Champs-Élysées in Paris was also a much-admired LGBTQ rights activist. Javier Jugalet was shot in the head, and two other police officers and a bystander were wounded by the single gunman, who was killed by police as he tried to flee the area. The 37-year-old Jugalet was a member of a French association of LGBT police officers called FLAG. The group's president, Michael Boucheron, told the New York Times that Jukolay participated in the organization's protest against Russia's no-promo-homo law during the 2014 Winter Olympics in Sochi. He was a simple man who loved his job, Bucheron said. He was really committed to the LGBT cause. Tributes to the fallen officer, who leaves behind a husband and other family members, have poured in from around the country and around the world. French President François Hollande said an official tribute is being planned. ISIS claimed responsibility for this week's attack, which took place 3 days before the first round of the French presidential election.
Now, if you poll psychiatrists, they're going to tell you that transgender is a disease.
That's U.S. President Donald Trump's pick for Secretary of the Army, Tennessee State Senator Mark Green, during a Chattanooga Tea Party meeting late last year. His anti-queer record includes sponsoring a clone of North Carolina's so-called bathroom bill. He also backed a bill that would have allowed Tennessee teachers to refuse to address any issues in the classroom that conflicted with their religious beliefs, widely viewed as an anti-LGBTQ bill, and a successful proposal that allows therapists to refuse to accept LGBTQ patients. If he's confirmed by the U.S. Senate as expected, Green will ironically replace Obama appointee Eric Fanning, the first openly gay man to serve as Army Secretary. During his tenure, Fanning helped guide the Pentagon through the end of its ban on transgender enlistees. The American Military Partner Association, the nation's largest group of LGBTQ military spouses and their families, joined several other human rights groups to express strong opposition to the Green nomination. Based on his vicious anti-LGBT record, the group said in a media statement, Mark Green cannot be trusted to ensure all those who serve have the support they need and deserve. For the record, the American Psychiatric Association stopped listing gender identity disorder as a disease in 2012.
Meanwhile, the Alabama Supreme Court has upheld the suspension of its Chief Justice, far-right homophobe Roy Moore, citing his disregard for binding federal law. The state high court justices agreed that Moore illegally ordered probate judges in his state to ignore the U.S. Supreme Court's June 2015 marriage equality ruling and to deny licenses to same-gender couples. The Alabama Court of the Judiciary, the state panel that disciplines judges, ordered the suspension of Moore in September. He lost his appeal at the state Supreme Court this week. At a news conference, Moore blamed the Southern Poverty Law Center, which filed the original complaint against him, and certain transgendered and homosexual groups for his politically motivated prosecution.
I've done my duty under the laws of this state, he said, to uphold the sanctity of marriage and the undeniable truth that God ordained marriage as a union of one man and one woman. Moore, not surprisingly a Republican, is said to be considering a run for governor in 2018 or for the U.S. Senate later this year. He said he'll announce his plans sometime soon after discussions with his family.
But finally, he's a basketball legend and a tireless advocate for the rights of people living with HIV/AIDS since shocking the world in 1991 with the announcement that he's HIV positive. He's now a leading Los Angeles area businessman with additional interest in the city's Dodgers baseball and Lakers basketball franchises. Irvin Magic Johnson is also the proud father of EJ, his out and sometimes gender-bending gay son. The elder Johnson had some advice for other parents of non-conforming LGBTQ kids during his appearance on the Ellen DeGeneres Show this week.
I think it's all about you not trying to decide what your daughter or son should be or what you want them to become. It's all about loving them no matter who they are, what they decide to do. And when my son came out, I was so happy for him and happy for us as parents. And we love him, and EJ is amazing. So you gotta support your child, because there's so many people who try to discriminate against them, so they need you to support them, because if you don't support them, who's gonna support them and love them? You know, it's really important.
That's News Wrap for the week ending April 22nd, 2017, produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK, Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Michael LeBeau.
And I'm Jessica Andrea.
There hasn't really ever been a British version of Paris is Burning or something that celebrates the UK underground scene.
Well, that's not true anymore, as you'll discover later in the program.
My car got stopped at a Chechen police checkpoint, and they asked me for my documents. They looked at them and said, "We are taking you."
That's the disguised voice of one of three Chechen gay refugees who spoke anonymously with CNN this week. Others told their stories to the New York Times. As This Way Out's Lucia Chappell reports, mainstream media is finally starting to pay attention.
One thing is clear. There is a concerted effort to exterminate all gay, perceived gay, and bisexual men in the predominantly Muslim Chechnya region of Russia. Chechen President Ramzan Kadyrov proudly admitted to the genocidal campaign this week. The pal of Russian President Vladimir Putin promised to rid his area of all gay and bisexual men before the observance of Ramadan at the end of May. As of this report, well over 100 men have been rounded up and detained in what are increasingly being called gay concentration camps, the first in Europe since the Nazis did it more than 75 years ago. Lured in by entrapment through fake romantic social media exchanges, detainees are being tortured to extract the names of their friends and acquaintances. The Chechen men featured on CNN this week were among the lucky ones to have escaped to underground safe houses in Moscow. Another disguised gay Chechen survivor told CNN about his experience.
They started beating me with their fists and feet. They wanted to get names of my gay friends from me. Then they tied wires to my hands and put metal clippers on my ears to electrocute me. They've got special equipment which is very powerful. When they shock you, you jump high above the ground.
A spokesman for Chechen President Kadyrov claimed last week that no gays are being persecuted in Chechnya because there are no gays there. Following up on that preposterous assumption, Kadyrov himself whined this week that he's the victim of a smear campaign by human rights groups. Those claims went unchallenged when he was interviewed by the Russian government-sponsored TV network RT late this week.
The whole world has united against our country, against the nation. They seek every opportunity to counter Putin. The name Kadyrov is heard everywhere, but nothing is said about those who are corrupt. There is no evidence of any crime that they accuse me of. Every day they write articles on nonsense, not backed by anything. Every time it's something new. The national and local press discuss it. And I'm saying, prove it. If you don't have proof, then I'm not guilty.
Putin Press Secretary Dmitry Peskov insisted late this week that investigators have found no evidence to support the claims of the purge and that the Russian leader has no reason to doubt Kadyrov's repeated denials. Human Rights Watch has documented at least three deaths in the homophobic pogrom so far, one who died during torture, and two others were victims of so-called honor killings by shamed family members after their release from detention. So, as a third relatively safe in Moscow survivor of the genocidal campaign told CNN this week,
if my family finds out that I'm gay, then no authorities, no troops are needed. They will kill me themselves. Even if my parents will forgive me, someone, like my uncle, won't forgive.
The reporter who first broke the news about the gay purge has fled the country. A jihad was issued against Elena Milishina and those she works with at the independent Russian newspaper Novaya Gazeta for tarnishing the honor of the Chechen nation. Milishina told the Washington Post this week that she'll continue to do her job despite the death threats. Today or tomorrow, she said, the Kremlin will have to deal with the situation. Reporting for This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappell.
I'm Roman Kalinin from Moscow. You are listening to This Way Out,
the showpiece of the homosexual movement in the United States.
Оставайтесь на нашей волне.
Stay on our wavelength.
The drag world in the States may plant its pumps on the pop side, the London scene is more powered by punk. The writer-director of an award-winning documentary about that scene brought three of his stars to the last drag con in Los Angeles, where This Way Out's Michelle Marie Gilkison explored their fabulousness.
I'm the director of the film, Colin Rothbart.
Why did you make the film? What was your goal?
I was on holiday with Holstein, actually, about 7 years ago now in India, and we were in the sea, and she suddenly said, oh, do you know what, there hasn't really ever been a British version of Paris is Burning or something that celebrates the UK underground scene. And we always saw people out and about with cameras, and it seemed that, you know, nothing was really ever happening to this footage. And I thought, well, that's a bit weird, really. So I thought, I will, you know, start filming performances. And I went down to Glastonbury, where the guys here do a thing called The Down Low. And it took a long time to win people's trust. Obviously, I knew Holstein. And Amber only came on board, for example, after we'd been filming for about a year or so, because she wasn't living in London. And then we thought, oh, she's got a great story to tell as well. Yeah, it was always to try to celebrate this scene. You know, we all look back now on Paris is Burning and think, oh, thank God that was captured. Otherwise, you know, if you don't see it, you know, it's sort of like in your mind didn't really exist. And so for people that are here today who haven't experienced London, this is an authentic slice of London at its high point, really.
Me, I'm John Sizzle. That's quite an important thing. That's what I sort of take out, well, hope a lot of people take out from the film, not just the fact that I'm HIV positive and I'm nearly 50. I prefer the whole sort of Waltons aspect of it. It's a real buzzy community. We all knew each other. We were all coming together at that time and we were all feeding off each other's excitement. Other sort of global phenomena that the world might recognise the Brits for, things like punk or the New Romantics. I think what was going on with us in the early noughties was basically the beginning of a new movement, which Johnny brought to the fore. Johnny Wu had come back from New York, where he was doing some real avant-garde alternative performance using drag. And when he came back, he started doing it in a local pub and acting like a magnet, and people were joining him and bringing their own version of creativity to his stage. And that just grew, and it became this really natural, organic movement of real punky drag queens. There was so much love around. It's not a commune as such, or a clique, but it was a bit like...
community.
It was a community, but that's just like a bit of a dull word, community. It's a bit worthy. We were laughing like drains. We were arguing. There were tears, there were people like having complete hissy fits and being ridiculous.
But people were there for each other, just like when Amber wanted to raise money for her boobs. She had a boobathon and then she raised about £4,500, which paid for most of the boobs, didn't it?
Yeah,
and that just shows that how much love there is obviously on the scene for you and also for the people that make people have so much fun in East London, doesn't it?
And I think for our drag family as well. I know you hear, like, especially over here, like with RuPaul's Drag Race, there's like drag mummies and then like their offspring and that kind of thing, and I get that completely, but with us it's much more a real kind of thing. It's much more of a kind of honest thing. It's not just about helping each, you know, like saying, hey, this is my look, you're going to be the protege of my look. We're actually genuinely and really helping each other with real life issues. And
if you want some American reference points, I think we're a bit more John Walters about it. There's a lot of dysfunction, which is normal. There's quite a few gargoyles in the gang. You know, there's people are nuts. We celebrate that. I mean, if anything, it makes it more rounded. And you sort of, you learn from it. And it makes it a lot more interesting, actually. I mean, I love my nutbags.
There's a line in the film, performers are all insecure creatures. Holstein says that.
I think with performers, we have a mask, and that's what we give to the audience. And we're all fragile, genuine people underneath with emotions, and we're a hot mess of real life. We're real people. The whole point is getting on stage, performing. Your vulnerabilities at home, you deal with that when you go home.
For some of us, actually, performance actually makes us a little bit more secure, knowing that you're getting loved and adorned and worshipped and stuff. When you're out there, you can actually come away and come off stage and think, oh, wow, you know, I was feeling a little bit terrible today, and I've just done a great performance. And so an uplifting thing.
I think as well, like Amber was saying, that it's a scary place to be on the stage on your own performing. And if you're a really insecure person, that's a very tough thing to do. And I think that to get on that stage takes quite a lot of self-awareness and strength. And as you go along performing, you become stronger and stronger. So it's not just about the adulation of the audience. Sometimes it's a lot of it is about forcing yourself into situations to help yourself grow and become a stronger person.
It's also pushing it down, because you can't go on stage, get all the applause and walk off stage and still think you're amazing, because that is fake, it's fleeting. So it's good to kind of go, yes, I was good, and put it down and move on to the next show. Or even when it's a bad show, you kind of go, okay, whatever, move on, and go back and sit in my boxer shorts with my dog, and that's real life. But just keep on going, because some people can go crazy for being performers because they just believe the hype, they believe the applause, and that's not real. It's fabulous, but it's not real.
It's your work. I mean, you can go home and congratulate yourself for winning a case if you're a lawyer, or you can go home, you're a midwife, you've delivered a couple of sextuplets or two, and you haven't run anyone over in driving school. You know, you can congratulate yourself, but ultimately, if you're a performer, especially a drag performer, don't believe the hype, because you will end up very disappointed once the Botox wears off, you know?
Which brings me to another point in the film about drag being a young person's game.
Why are you looking at me? I'm 17. Well, my drag age is 15, I think. It's a young person's game to a certain extent. A lot of drag is about excitement and the thrill of the new. And I suppose as you do things over and over again, the excitement of that wears off. So as you get older, you just think, oh my God, just let the kids do it. But in the movie, when I talk about that, I think the thing is I was getting a bit trapped by drag. Drag was doing me as opposed to me doing drag. And as I put my fees up and started getting more money, I started to enjoy it a bit more, I think. But I suppose...
It's the late night.
Yeah, it's the late nights, it's the alcohol, it's... You have to watch yourself. I mean, and you need a lot of excitement to give a lot of excitement. And these kids are throwing themselves on the floor. You will not see me doing that. I might throw up on the floor, but I won't throw myself on the floor.
Give him a few, like, sandy boozes, though, and I think you probably would see him doing that.
And there's only so much of your physical self you're prepared to give up for drag.
Scotty talks in the film about a sense of control over the viewer or the audience. Can you talk about if drag is seen as a way of controlling something for each of you?
Ooh, it is, isn't it? I mean, you are create... If you've got something to say... You're creating a world in which to say it. You're a spokesperson, you are a politician, you have got everyone's attention.
What have you got to say?
We're just showing people the London side of drag, because obviously the whole world is seeing American drag, which is absolutely amazing, but it's very American. There's a London sensibility.
Very polished.
It's very polished, but there's a sensibility around it as well. I mean, I'm here at this convention trying to work out exactly what it is, because I'm seeing it live. It's basically like a Spice Girls show concert. It's like everyone is so enthusiastic for it. You won't get this in London.
No.
You won't get this type of gentleness around it. I think there's a lot more... It's a bit scratchier in London, the drag scene.
I think in London, though, we focus more on performance, variety of performance, because American drag, as fabulous as it is very much like a polished look and looking flawless and camera ready and the lip syncing, whereas we kind of sing more, there's more comedians, there's more people actually doing magic, doing all different, you know, creating their own music as well, so we're kind of like far more driven creatively than just the look. Because if you've seen the film, we all look like a bunch of hot messes rolling around a field. There's some glamorous people like Amber, of course, but the rest of us are just a fraggly hot mess. Nothing's good or nothing's bad. Everything's valid. There's a bit of drag for everyone.
What do you think of the looks, though, Amber? Because here it's quite different. It's quite macabre.
There's one thing of actually getting dressed up and doing your da-da, this is me, this is my outfit, but then have you got anything to actually say? And any message to give out, rather than I'm fabulous and stuff. So,
and that's what we tried to, like, you know, make the film be about as well, rather than it just being like a home video for the scene in East London. Everyone here has got like their own story to tell. So whether it's like Amber going through her transitioning, John talking about, you know, ageism or HIV, or Holstar talking about obviously, like, you know, having a tranny with a fanny and like being a woman who loves drag.
A fanny
it means something quite different in the UK. Yeah.
Vagina.
Yeah. A lady part, lady garden. Then also celebrating a scene which, when we were filming, thankfully was at its high point. So, you know, it's documenting it for the future.
It seems like there's definitely this inclusiveness in the film, that the fact that we have people who are transitioning and there's never a question of, do you belong here?
Yeah.
And that there are trannies with fannies, and that you can tell there's a little bit of tension from time to time, but it's never a question of, are you one of us?
Gender doesn't define what you do. Everyone says to be a drag queen, you've got to be a man in a frock. And people say, are you a bio queen? Are you a faux queen? No, I'm a drag queen. I'm a drag performer. And last year I won this award, Best Drag Act at London Cabaret Awards. And people kicks off. People are like, oh my God, it's a woman. It's like, I do the same job as you. I just don't tuck and my titties are real. Everything else I do is I'm projecting, I'm taking on different energies. It's still drag. What's in my pants is no one else's business. Are you entertained? That's all I care about. If not, I'll give you your money back. There you go.
We want to raise awareness so that people all around the world can hopefully get inspired. And I know that that was one of the reasons why you, Amber, wanted to do it too, wasn't it? So that someone would be, you know, maybe watching this in Nigeria or in Russia, places where, you know, maybe transitioning is so much harder. This will hopefully help them on their way.
Yeah, absolutely. That was the one main reason why I got involved in the movie at the very beginning.
Has your relationship to the meaning of drag evolved at all?
Not necessarily. It's still all about a performance and it's all about giving what you want. But going through my transition and stuff like that, I guess I personally see myself more now as a performer rather than a drag performer. I'm trying to kind of like lose that kind of aspect to my performance. I want to kind of like cross over into more of a kind of like a mainstream, broader section of people. And I think that has very much come from a deep-rooted sense of going through a lot of personal things myself and a lot of working out to do myself with my transition and where I think I fit in society. Absolutely, our movie is very much a positive message about doing things for yourself and getting out there and
staying true to yourself.
Staying true to yourself.
Don't hide, have a wonderful time and be fabulous.
And come to the Glory in East London and have a drink on John Sizzle.
And remember, folks, don't do drugs, stick to drag.
That was Dressed as a Correspondent, Michelle Marie Gilkison, in conversation with Dressed as a Girl producer-director Colin Rothbart and stars John Sizzle, Amber Ways, and Holstar. For more information about the doc and its soundtrack, visit dragmovie.com. Thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. This week, Jessica Andrea, Michael LeBeau, Lucia Chappelle, and Michelle Marie Gilkison contributed program material, with thanks as always to Steve Pride. You heard War Boy featuring Johnny Wu and Holstar singing the title cut from the Dressed as a Girl soundtrack, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Yavanna Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our listener donors, for making this program possible. It's always a good time to log on to thiswayout.org and join the family. Look for This Way Out on Facebook, Twitter, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and Google+. Email tworadio@aol.com. or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappelle and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Greg Gordon. We thank you for listening online at thiswayout.org and on CFUV Victoria, British Columbia, 3GCR Morwell, Victoria, Gay SA Radio, Pretoria, South Africa, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.